Good afternoon, everybody. I think we're going to start now. We're a bit late, already. So I have the great pleasure today of introducing our keynote speaker, Christophe Jaffrelot. In fact, Christophe hardly needs an introduction, because among his many achievements is the fact that he is one of the best-known French social scientists working on South Asia today. This, of course, has to do with the strong international dimension of his academic career. In France, Christophe is attached to the série in Sciences Po, and he's associated to our own Centre d'études de l'Inde et de l'Asie du Sud, Center for South Asian Studies. Indeed, he has coordinated many seminars, research programs, and publications with us. And abroad, Christophe has been teaching in some of the best universities in the UK, the US, and Canada. His academic fame also has to do with the fact that he is a prolific author who has today written 9 books and edited or co-edited another 21 volumes. An author who can write for his fellow specialists as well as for a larger audience, and who is truly a scholar of South Asia as a specialist of India but also now of Pakistan. But the most important reason why Christophe needs no introduction, I think, is that he is the author of several books that have immediately become reference works for all of us who are interested in South Asia politics in general and in Indian democracy in particular. I will just mention 3 of them: The Hindu Nationalist Movement and Indian Politics, 1925 to the 1990s, India's Silent Revolution, The Rise of the Lower Castes in North India, and Religion, Caste, and Politics in India. These 3, because these have been landmarks in my own understanding of contemporary India. And I will now leave the floor to Christophe so that he can tell us whether India today is becoming an ethnic democracy or not.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Ines, for inviting me to give this keynote address. I have prepared a presentation that is supposed to interest every social scientist interested in South Asia. I have really tried not to be too much of a political scientist, but this is my discipline, and I'd like to begin with some references to what the political scientists are working on these days, interested in today. And those who admit that liberal democracy is not the only game in town are striving to qualify these democratic regimes that do not abide by the principles of the genre. These hybrid democracies are tagged with epithets such as illiberal or even authoritarian, and India is not immune to this trend. Under Narendra Modi, the world's largest democracy has taken on the features of a certain authoritarianism, stoked by national populism. I'm going to explore another dimension of the Indian democratic regression, and that is majoritarianism. And there, the theoretical framework that proves most useful is that of ethnic democracy. As many of you know, Catherine Adeney mentioned that in the panel I was part of, this notion of an ethnic democracy, this very theory of the ethnicization of democracy, has been introduced in political science by Sami Smuha, who explains that this brand of democracy is primarily the product of ethnic nationalism, the ideology of a majoritarian group based on racial, linguistic, religious, or any other cultural characteristic. That implies a strong sense of belonging and often of superiority. This identity goes along with rejection of the minorities, generally perceived as threats to the survival of the ethnic nation. For Samir Smua, who is based in Israel, who was a professor at Haifa University, Israel precisely, is the archetype of the ethnic democracy. And I'd like to refer to his own model, because I think it tells us something about the India of today. In his model, an ethnic democracy like Israel implies two-tiered citizenship, the majority enjoying more rights than the minorities, both de jure and de facto. And I insist on this very important characterization, and I'll return to it. In Israel, Jews have more rights because the state officially recognizes their religion. And I'm sure you noticed that last week it went one step further in this very direction. But Jewish dominance at the expense of Muslims or Arabs is also exercised de facto. And I'd like to emphasize this again. Smua says most of the discrimination is rather covert. The extensive use of military service as a criterion for the allocation of benefits is very striking, because most Jews serve in the army, whereas most Arabs do not. Unfair allocation of funds and provision of unequal services by governmental offices are quite common, and so on and so forth. So this idea that you have the de jure distinction, the state is the state of the Jews, but you have also the de facto discrimination. And this was acknowledged by the Orr Commission, named after Theodore Orr, the former Supreme Court Justice who presided it. It was appointed in October 2000 after the repression of the police claimed the life of 13 Arab and Palestinians. The commission said, I quote, Israeli democracy is not democratic towards the Arabs to the same extent that it is democratic towards the Jews. Some are more equals than others. We are back to the Orwellian world that we know so well these days. I have insisted on this because I do think that the trajectory of India under Narendra Modi has moved towards this model while exhibiting a specific variant of it. The main difference lies in the fact that there is no major legal reform. That may happen. But for the moment, the constitution is the same. It is supposed to refer to secularism as one of its key principles. So the de jure aspect of ethnic democracy is not there, but I'm going to present the de facto dimension of this trajectory towards ethnic democracy. And I will do it in two parts. The first one looking at the formal dimensions, the vanishing of the Muslims from sites of power, from institutions. And the second part will be focusing on the impact of vigilantism, not as something implemented by mobs. And I know that panels took place on this, so I'm looking forward to the conversation we'll have in the Q&A. Because we may disagree on that. Mobs are not the primary actors. Vigilante groups, very well organized vigilante groups, are responsible for that. That's the second part of my presentation. So first of all, the institutional occultation of the order, the vanishing of the Muslims from main institutions of India. The first thing to say here we need to qualify the idea that it is a recent phenomenon. There are many sites of power. There are many institutions in India from where Muslims had been eliminated, so to speak, or at least obliterated since the beginning. I've just compiled, with the help of Shweta Bhutara, one of my students at Sciences Po, a data set showing that if you look at the sociology of the police, and if you focus on the IPS officers, the elite groups, you realize that Muslims had never been more than 5% of the policemen. And this arcs back to the 50s. It's not a new development. And this, of course, has to be disaggregated. If you remove from the totals the percentage of policemen from Jammu and Kashmir, the situation is even worse, because, of course, in Jammu and Kashmir, you have Muslim policemen. So if you remove Jammu and Kashmir, you end up with, today, 2.5% of the IPS officers who are Muslim. And the gap has increased because today Muslims are something like 14.5% of society. They were something like 10.5% in the 50s. So the gap in terms of percentage points has never been so great. Why is it important? It is important because if you do not have people from your community in the police station, or if the Jawans do not report to people of their community, or from the community of the plaintiffs in the police station, it's much more difficult for the minorities to relate to the state confidently. And I'd like to refer here to a very recent report that has been understudied, under-publicized at least, the Status of Policing in India report that the CSDS and an NGO called Common Cause have just released. It says that 64% of Muslims are highly or somewhat fearful of the police. It is the highest percentage. No community fears the police as much as the Muslims. And when you try to understand why, the main reason is that police often implicates Muslims under false terrorism charges. And we do know that there are in Indian jails hundreds, maybe more, thousands of young Muslims who have been arrested by the police under some terrorism charge, and they'll be in jail till the trial comes, and many of them, when the trial will come, will be released because there is no reason why they should be in jail. In fact, there is a fascinating data that has been given by the Crime Bureau saying that the percentage of those in prison is 21%. Muslims in prison, 21%. The percentage of Muslims imprisoned as convicts is 15.8%, not much more than their share in the population. The gap is what? Police bias. Police, I think, is one of the places where Muslims have never been represented, and they are not more represented now than they used to be. The army, I will not elaborate too much on the situation of the Muslims in the army because of the book Stephen Wilkinson has published recently and which says it all, not only about the Muslims but about the social profile of the Indian army. In the army, Muslims are not welcome and have never been welcome. In fact, the share of the Muslims dropped from 32% in 47 to 2% immediately afterwards. And Jawaharlal Nehru was very worried about that. He said in 53, in our different services, there are hardly any Muslims left. What concerns me most is that there is no effort being made to improve the situation, which is likely to grow worse unless checked. And it is what has happened. Stephen shows in his book that today there is something like 1% of the higher-ranking officers of the army who are Muslims. And in the 80s, George Fernandez, who was to become defense minister, declared himself, the Muslim is not wanted in the armed forces because he is always suspect. Whether we want to admit it or not, most Indians consider Muslims a fifth column from Pakistan. Third, what about the IAS? What about the administrative service? Well, the story is very similar to the story of the IPS, in fact. In fact, it's even more surprising. The graph we have done, we have compiled the data from 78 till 2016 with my colleagues of the Trivedi Center for Political Data at Ashoka University and Gilles Vernier's in particular. It shows that there have never been more than 5% of Muslims joining the IAS since the 70s. And in many years, in several years, you can see it, zero Muslim made it. Just zero. Why is it counterintuitive? The trend is rather better now than it used to be. But minimally, we have reached something like 3.5% of Muslims who made it in the IAS. So one more site of power where Muslims are completely underrepresented. So then you could conclude that, well, in fact, India has always been an ethnic democracy. In many ways, you can argue, like Kralpal Singh did, that there was no place for minorities right from the beginning. Except that there was one institution, there was one site of power where Muslims were represented, and that was the parliament. That was not only the parliament, but also the assemblies of the states, the state assemblies, the Vidhan Sabhas. And that has changed. If you look at this table, only the last column, you realize that Muslims were 9% of the MPs of the Lok Sabha in 1980, when it peaked, and it has almost constantly declined. There is somewhat like a linear trend towards less and less Muslims in parliament, and we have reached the nadir in 2014, when only 20 Muslims were elected in the Lok Sabha, making the percentage 3.7% of Muslims. Never before you had so few Muslims in the parliament. Why? Because BJP won, and BJP made a point not to nominate Muslim candidates. In 2014, only 7 Muslims were nominated. By the BJP, and none of them were elected. For the first time in the history of India, there was no Muslim MP in the group of the winning party. First time in the history of India. And they had a tough time finding ministers. They had to go to the Rajya Sabha to get a couple of ministers, only 2. Same. Never before you had so few ministers, Muslim ministers, in the Indian Union cabinet. There is a reason for that. BJP doesn't want to be accountable to Muslim voters. And the best way not to have anything to tell the Muslim voters is to have no Muslim candidate. There was a very interesting elaboration on this point by a UP leader of the BJP that says everyone was wooing the Muslims. You know, this idea that Muslims are a vote bank and Congress is running after this vote bank. We told the Hindus, they will unite. We will always remain divided. Trump in the US showed that it is not blacks and Hispanics and Muslims who will decide who becomes US president. It is whites. Here too, it is not Muslims who will decide who rules UP. It is all other Hindus. They want to defeat us. We want to defeat them and their parties. It is a battle. It's a very revealing convergence. All the national populists in the world today have more or less the same agenda. And white supremacists and Hindu supremacists share the same idea that the nation is not made of everybody, it is made of the largest majoritarian group, and the winning party, the ethnic nationalist party, has to represent them only. What is more surprising is that other parties, including Congress, stopped nominated Muslims as well. And I want to cut a long story short because I could go on for hours on this topic. But if you look at this somewhat complicated table showing the percentage of Muslims, the last column, in the candidates of some parties, you see that very few parties are giving tickets to Muslims in large proportions. You have the Trinamool Congress, 16%. You have the Rashtriya Janata Dal, 20.7%. You have the Samajwadi Party, 18.4%. Congress has only 5.6% of its candidates coming from the Muslim community. And BJP, 1.6. What is even more interesting is that if you go to the state level, and again we are doing with the Ashoka University Center for Political Data research on the Vidhan Sabhas, you realize that this is true almost everywhere. Most of the states have a diminishing proportion of Muslim MLAs. It is particularly true of Maharashtra, and I'll go quick because, again, we could spend too much time on that, but look at the trend only. Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan is interesting. When Congress wins, Muslim candidates win in larger numbers. When BJP wins, it goes back to almost zero. Look at this, Uttar Pradesh, fascinating. From SP to BJP, the proportion of Muslims dropped from 18 to 6% of the MLAs. The only states where Muslims are still represented in large numbers in the state assembly is West Bengal because of the Trinamool Congress. You may say, well, maybe Muslims don't want to be elected. Maybe they don't contest. So we looked at the candidates. And again, I will go quick, and I will review the candidates. The green bar is made of Muslim candidates. The blue bar is made of Muslim MLAs. The number of Muslim candidates constantly increased in the 90s. Muslims wanted to be part of this game. And they stopped to contest in large numbers when the deposits became more expensive. But they started to do it again, and you can't say they don't want to be there. They contest in large numbers. And it took us quite some time to find all these Muslim names on the list of the Election Commission, but here they are. So that's what is new so far as institutions are concerned. To conclude on this first part, I would say that if we look at institutions, you can definitely argue that there was something of an ethnic democracy in India as early as the 50s, so far as the presence of Muslims in the police, in the army, in the IAS was concerned. But there was something new because of the new dispensation, because of the rise of Hindu nationalism. You also see Muslims vanishing from elected assemblies. Now, that is only one part of the story. This is the formal, institutional dimension of what is an ethnic democracy. If we turn to the informal, to the de facto dimension, we have to look at the way vigilantes have become state actors. And that's the main point that I'm going to do in this second part. Well, vigilantism is a fascinating phenomenon in the world of today. Go to Russia today and you see how many vigilante groups are in fact imposing the morality, the law, and claim to be implementing the law. It's across the world. Look at what happened in the US as well, and we had so many examples of skirmishes and even riots between vigilantes and liberals. I would define it following two French colleagues, Gilles Favarel-Garrigue and Laurent Gaillet, who have just edited a superb volume of politics, not politics CS, politics IX, like Asterix politics, on vigilantism. And they say, vigilantism can be defined as a range of collective, coercive practices which are often violent and usually illegal, that aim to keep order and or mete out justice in order to enforce legal or moral norms. Legal or moral norms. Legal, we know. Moral, it has to do with legitimacy, not legality. And I'll return to this difference. Well, if we look at the history of vigilantism in India, we can certainly argue that RSS itself has affinities with vigilantism. In fact, it's inherent in the mission of the RSS, because this mission, in the first place, aims at working at the social, at the grassroots level, to organize the Hindus to defend their interest and to protect their identity. So it's a society-oriented agenda. Right from the beginning, Edgevar focused on this. Govalkar, the successor of Edgevar, reinforced that and resisted any attempt by Hindu Mahasabha or others to bring RSS in the political arena. Politics was not the natural arena for RSS. Society was. And the state, as a result, was not the target. To capture the state was not on the agenda. What was on the agenda was to convert society to the Hindutva ideology, and then the state would fall as a ripe fruit. And in his book, 1938, Govalkar says, in We or Our Nationhood Defined, we are out to understand the nationhood of Hindustan, which done, all questions regarding the form of the state shall be worth entrusting to the nation as we find it to exist. We build the nation first, and then we look at the state. We build the Hindu Rashtra first, and then we'll turn to the Hindu Raj. Well, this is something that had many implications. To build this Hindu Rashtra meant primarily to persuade Hindu society to believe in their version of Hinduism. And that was the rationale behind the shakas, branches at the grassroots level across the country, to convert, persuade the young Hindus to share their worldview of Hinduism, of the Indian history, and also to enforce rights, practices, traditions. While the RSS relied on social work and persuasion on the Shaka network for doing that, it never ruled out the use of constraint and violent means. In fact, the Swayamsevaks not only wore a paramilitary uniform and observed quasi-military discipline, but they were also trained on the Shaka to ply the lathi. This Janus-like dimension of the RSS means to be emphasized. On the one hand, it's social work. On the other hand, it can be disciplinary and paramilitary. It had to defend Hindus against other groups, including Muslims, against other Hindus, including pro-Muslim Hindus. This aspect, or this genus-like identity of RSS, became very clear during partition, at a time of crisis. And there is a fascinating speech by Goldwalker that you can find in the Nehru Memorial Library and record. At least you could find it. I hope you still find it. That was, in fact, a transcript of the intelligence services of the Nehru government. I'm going to read this page because it will, I hope, enlighten you to some extent. On 8 December 47, 4 months after partition, at 5 p.m., about 2,500 volunteers of the Sangh collected in their camp on Rohtak Road. After some drill, M.S. Goldwalker, the guru of the Sangh, addressed the volunteers. He explained the principles of the Sangh and said that it was the duty of every individual to be prepared for facing the coming crisis with full force. Very soon, they would be placing a complete scheme before them. The time for mere playing had gone. Our volunteers should enroll new volunteers in every house and should instill in them the essence of Hinduism. Referring to the government, he said that law cannot meet force. We should be prepared for guerrilla warfare on the lines of the tactics of Shivaji. The Sangh will not rest content until it has finished Pakistan. If anyone stood in our way, we will have to finish him too, whether it was Nehru government or any other government. The Sangh could not be won over. They should carry on their work. Referring to Muslims, he said he had no power, that no power on earth could keep them in Hindustan. They shall have to quit this country. Mahatma Gandhi wanted to keep the Muslims in India so that the Congress may profit by their votes at the time of election, but by that time, not a single Muslim will be left in India. If they were made to stay here, the responsibility would be the government's, and the Hindu community would not be responsible. Mahatma Gandhi could not mislead them any longer. We have the means whereby such men can be immediately silenced. But it is our tradition not to be inimical to Hindus. If we are compelled, we will have to resort to that course too. This speech is, of course, something that will be contradicted a few weeks later by the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. Because immediately, the ban by Nehru of RSS will hijack this agenda. RSS cannot be violent in the public sphere, at least because there is 20,000 Swayamsevaks behind the bars. So RSS fell back on the other dimension of the Janus-like mission I have mentioned before, social work. And they did social work. And somewhat subcontracted vigilantism to other organizations, including Bajrang Dal. And Bajrang Dal was created in the 80s to do the kind of work Goldwalker had mentioned in 47 and that the RSS could not do itself in the framework of the Ayodhya movement. This is history. Now, after 2014, a new chapter has been opened. And the situation has such so dramatically that the other side of the moon, so to speak, could be revealed and implemented. Since 2014, we've seen the Sangh Parivar becoming something like a parallel government, working, in fact, with the government. And that's why the idea of parallel government is not good. It's a continuum, much more than an alliance. There is clearly a converging interest and concerns of the RSS and the BJP to explain the rise of Hindu vigilantism. On one hand, the government remains clean, exterior to any illegal anti-minority action. But these actions are in tune with his its ideology. On the other hand, the Tsangpa River, because it has nothing to fear from the state anymore, can unleash its agenda at the grassroots level. And I repeat, this is what matters the most. RSS wants to change society at the grassroots level. To do something the state cannot do. The state cannot change the psyche of people. They don't believe in this top-down kind of transformation. It has to be done at the grassroots level. They have to do it, but to do it more effectively, they need some blessing from the state. At least the state should not interfere with their own agenda. Between 2014 and 2019, because I'm sure there'll be no difference in the coming month, the Pearl River has launched various types of campaign: Love Jihad, campaigns against conversions to Islam and Christianity, Gar Vapsi, against Muslim occupation of the urban space, you can somewhat call it land jihad, and that happened in Gurgaon recently when namaz was not possible in public space, and of course, fight against cow slaughter. I'm going to focus on Love Jihad briefly and the cow protection movement afterwards. The first campaign in this series was initiated as early as September 2014 in the name of anti-Love Jihad activities. In September 2014, the organizer of the mouthpiece of RSS had a front page article against Love Jihad, and the article was saying there are examples of feigning love followed by devastating tales of pain, suffering, blackmailing, and torture for conversion. The idea was that Muslim men may seduce Hindu girls, but in the end, the idea is to convert them to Islam. That was the idea, and I do not mention what happened in UP with the Romeo Squad and so on. That's the RSS, only RSS-sponsored organization. So what was seen as somewhat spontaneous reaction towards inter-community marriages was in fact very clearly fine-tuned by RSS organizations. RSS phoning always ad hoc groups. You have one group for each task. In that particular case, they created the Hindu Behen Bedi Bachao Sangharsh Samiti, Save Hindu Sisters and Daughters Committees. Activists offered to help parents who lamented their daughter's marriage to a Muslim, but they sometimes also undertook preemptive action owing to a vast network of informers in police stations and courts where parents might go to report a missing daughter. Their methods were revealed by journalists for two investigative news websites, Cobra Post and Gulal.com. Posing as students sympathetic to the Hindu nationalist cause, they recorded their conversations with activists using hidden cameras. The first task of these organizations appeared that they had first to convince young Hindu women not to marry with their Muslim fiancé. And one of the BJP MLAs, Sangeet Som, from Muzaffarnagar district, declared in a very interesting reflection of the way they were using moral pressure at the grassroots level, "We make the girl see the reason that it is not good for her. We tell her that they are Muslims. They never settle for one woman, whereas a Hindu boy will be automatically sent to jail if he does so. On the other hand, a Muslim can marry up to four women, and those women can adjust among themselves. Most importantly, we exert on her emotionally, saying that her mother will die, her father will die, and brother might even commit suicide, and he would not be able to face the society." If persuasion failed, and we are really in one dimension of vigilantism that we often miss, the anti-Hindu or the vigilante activities vis-a-vis Hindus. If persuasion failed, then there are other techniques. And an RSS leader from Muzaffarnagar again, Omkar Singh, who described the way he rescued 125 girls from the clutches of Muslims and remarried them to Hindu men, says that usually they file fake cases, rape and kidnapping cases, against the Muslim boy, and then rescue the girl and marry her to a Hindu boy. We don't let the girl appear in court for days if she doesn't want to give a testimony that she has been kidnapped and raped. We say that the girl is not listening. The police say it's all right. We will see her tomorrow. If she isn't listening even tomorrow, they say it's all right. They help us a lot. They send her mother to us to talk. We are not allowed to do that. They help us a lot. Judges help us, so does the SSP, Senior Superintendent of Police. The judge gives the girl to us in his judgment. He hands her over to her parents. Once she's under her parents' control, we can get her married in 3 days. This is at least the way they see their vigilante activities. Now turn to the most important case, that is the vigilante activities vis-à-vis cow protection. And that will be my last but longest point. Well, you know the story by heart because you read newspapers. And you know that between 2015 and 2017, even 2018 now, we have seen in North and Western India a series of lynchings of Muslims, which followed almost an identical scenario. The Muslims are accused of cattle smuggling, of consuming beef. They are attacked and in dozens of cases died of their wounds. The first murder was, of course, the murder of Muhammad Akhlaq in September 2015 in Dadri, not far from Noida. That day, a group of young Hindus gathered near Akhlaq's house at 10 p.m. Among them was the son of the local BJP leader and his cousin. The mob took the temple priest into announcing over the loudspeaker that Akhlaq ate beef. They stormed his house and exhibited meat taken from his refrigerator, claiming it was beef. Akhlaq was savagely beaten and later died of his injuries in hospital in Noida. The lynching of Pehlu Khan is sadly even more typical, and that's the only case I would refer to in detail, the only other one, because Khan was a breeder specialized in dairy cows, and he was on his way home to Haryana after being purchased cattle in Rajasthan when his truck was intercepted on National Highway 8. Some 50 Hindu youth forcibly searched it, accused him of taking his animal to slaughter. He was beaten severely, as were his sons. He died shortly thereafter, but not before giving the police the name of his assailants when they arrived on the scene. But the police never troubled the suspects. There were many other similar cases in not only Haryana, Rajasthan, but also Jharkhand. Such a banalization of evil, if you want to paraphrase Hannah Arendt, has, of course, something to do with the same process, dehumanization. And the dehumanization of the Muslim could be a separate lecture altogether. But this is a precondition. This is what makes this possible. And I don't give details, but the way these people are lynched is itself telling us something about the mindset of the assailants. What is important here is that if you look at press reports, if you look at hashtags, mob lynchings, it is always attributed, these lynchings are always attributed to mobs, as if it was a spontaneous action. When in fact, when you look at it in detail, it is orchestrated by rather well-organized groups, which most of them have ramification with the RSS. The most visible Hindu organization in this domain is the Gaurakshat Dal. The Gaurakshat Dal has its headquarters in Haryana. Haryana is a stronghold. You find it also in Punjab, you find it also in West UP, even in many different organizations. Gaurakshat Dal is a very interesting organization simply because it is emulating, if you remember, the iconography of Indian Mujahideen It is emulating the iconography of the Islamic terrorists. Same weapons. And same technique in some ways. It's a group that is known, again, because of investigative journalists, including Ishan Marvel, who wrote a terrific story, terrific because it went very deep in this movement, in the caravan. He managed to be accepted into a GRD group in Haryana, patrolling the highway between Chandigarh and Delhi. These people were displaying the same kind of iconography, but were also using not so much AK-47, but Oki bats, the way others do in other countries. These people searched trucks likely to be transporting cows and beat up the drivers when they were Muslims. Hindus were merely reprimanded. What is interesting here is that the GRD worked in collaboration, in coordination with the police. And one of the policemen explained to Marvel, "We put up checkpoints and wait. The GRD vigilantes," he calls them volunteers, "keep driving around and call us when they find something. See, we have 100 other things to think of besides cows. These guys do the job. It's good, right? Prashasan bhi pura saath de raha hai bab." Now the administration is also supporting them fully. So if the government of Haryana is supporting them, why should the police object to what they are doing? On the contrary, we should work together. Divide the labor division. Well, this osmosis is very interesting because, of course, you have all these guys patrolling at night with the police. And by the way, all these are photographs they publicize themselves, because what is the objective? Heroism. Yeah. You're someone. You're breaking the back of Muslims all nights. That gives you some sense of self-esteem. That gives you some identity. But this is the lumpen dimension. And we should not focus on this lumpen dimension only, because then we would also say, oh, the mob is doing the job. It's a kind of mob. But behind the mob is an organization. And one of the leaders, Satish Kumar, shows how these organizations can go berserk. It's very interesting to see how gradually they realized that they could not only kill Muslims, but also make money. And extortion became a kind of parallel activity, an extortion with the gun. And the way Satish Kumar, who was the GRD president of the Punjab branch, created a gang, a private army, literally, on the basis of cow protection. That was too much for Modi, and you may remember that in August 2016, Narendra Modi declared that something like 70 to 80% of the cow vigilantes were in fact criminals and had to be dealt with accordingly. This man, Satish Kumar, was arrested a few days later under charges including extortion and rioting. But the RSS chief himself, Bhagwat, Mohan Bhagwat, spoke in favor of the cow vigilantists. And Modi has to transform his 70 to 80% into a handful. It's very important to keep this in mind. We are focusing on Modi as the main actor in this play. He's not. and the tree should not hide the forest behind. This forest is, and that's my last point, is now completely imbricated in the state apparatus. The Haryana government has created its own branch of co-protectors. It is known as the Gao Seva Ayog, and the Gao Seva Ayog is made of RSS people. This is a group of 12 people. Most of them are RSS leaders, Tsangchalak, or even former Pracharaks, which are at the interface between the state and the Gao Rashtradal. In fact, they come from the Gao Rashtradal, but they have now been hired by the government. This is the Indurashtra in action. It's part of the state, but it's a new dimension of the state. And they work in collaboration with the police. Baniram Bangla is the chairman of this Haryana Gao Seva Ayog, an RSS person. And Bharti Arora is the deputy inspector general in charge of the police, which has been created, a special police force. It is called the Cow Task Force. Some IPS officers have been seconded to a special cow task force in the Haryana police only to take care of cow protection. And they work in collaboration with RSS people who have been appointed by the state government in this Ayog. So we have a new kind of state formation. And that's what I would like to conclude upon, this idea of state formation being an idea I drew from Bruce Brayman and John Lonsdale, who tell us you have state building, police, judiciary, and you have state formation. Who is really meaningful at the grassroots level? Where is the authority laying? And the authority is not necessarily laying in the legal, formal state apparatus. It can be laying in the legitimate, not necessarily legal, but legitimate sources of authority. And they are legitimate because they represent the majority. And the majority has to prevail. This is a democratic rule. Democracy, after all, is the rule of majority. And I will end up with referring again to Sami Smua. In an ethnic democracy, the majority is for democracy. They are fully behind the democratic philosophy. The majority has to rule. What is interesting, and I will end with citing Sami Smua, is that, of course, it has many implications. Smua concludes, the Israeli case demonstrates the viability of an ethnic democracy as a distinct type of democracy in deeply divided societies. As a mode of conflict resolution, it is superior to genocide, ethnic cleansing, involuntary population transfer, and systems of non-democratic domination. It works, provided the minority accepts to be made of second-class citizens. And this is an invitation for the minorities to remain second-class citizens. The future will tell us how far this is the trajectory India is embarking upon.